Welcome back to The Screen Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us for the second part of the show today is another local, Phyllis Robinson, who's a chocolate maker and also, of course, the owner and founder of Tandem Chocolate. So, Phyllis, thanks for joining us this morning.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
Well, let's start with the basics. Tell us about Tandem Chocolates and what you do.
So we are a boutique chocolate shop. And so I am a chocolatier. So I make bonbons and truffles and confections and all sorts of wonderful things with chocolate.
That also happen to be really beautiful. We're looking at some in the studio right now.
Yeah. Oh, what?
Yeah. You missed that.
That's okay. I already let her know that you got yours last night, Chris,
yesterday.
So you don't try to hog any of hers.
I'm not sharing.
Thank you very much for those. And we're going to get to some of where you get your chocolate and how you source your chocolate and the environmental lens, let's say, you look through in running your operation and getting a chocolate. But Phyllis was interesting. She forwarded me this article out of the Washington Post that talked about the challenges that are going on in West Africa with child labor and the use of child labor to harvest a lot of cocoa, particularly in the country of Ivory Coast. And the challenges, let's say, the challenges that large industrial chocolate, big chocolate, we'll call it. Big cocoa? Well, how about that? Big cocoa?
I like that, yeah.
Like Mars and Nestle and Hershey are having and trying to, commit to limiting and reducing and eliminating child labor in those fields and in those plantations. You read the article. What were your takeaways from that article?
So a couple of things. I mean, one of the challenges is that, as a consumer, we want to have, the best product for the least possible price. Mm-hmm. So some of that kind of pushes down to the folks who, in the case of chocolate, who are actually growing and are harvesting the chocolate. So there's an incentive to keep wages low. So that the price can hit the rack in the grocery store for your, Twix bar or whatever it might be, mm-hmm. Which is still kind of crazy now. I mean, maybe it's just my age when I think about, it's like, I look at it and it's like, it's a dollar for a small bag of M&Ms? That just seems wrong.
Right.
So sure. I think that's definitely a piece of it. We're an area, working, obviously it's in areas where there aren't a lot of educational or economic opportunities. We see a lot of the Ivory Coast traffic is, actually coming in from like Burkina Faso.
Right.
So it's coming from other places as well. Some of it with the promise of an education. I mean, there's been a multi-point platform that's been put out by many chocolate growers and over the years that consistently on sustainability issues, on education, on building schools. But it's hard to make all those pieces work. Oversight is very low. I mean, it's not like you can just walk down the street and take a look.
Right.
And the other challenge we run into, particularly in West African chocolate, is that we have growers and folks who are going to be monitoring, but it's really hard to know that you have, you don't have child labor involved in your chocolate when your beans are, when they're growing pieces and then harvesting and then making your confections that don't have a single point of origin. So there may be beans from various plantations, from various countries, which makes it even harder to say this is there isn't any child labor involved in this project.
Well, I can imagine it's been a little bit of a journey for you probably as you started your company thinking like, oh, I'll just buy this cocoa from X.
Yeah.
Right.
And have you kind of slowly figured this out, slowly learned? What's that process?
I have. And I think we see lots of fair trade labels on things.
Sure.
We're like, okay, I'm going to start with fair trade. Great. That seems like it's a really good thing. And it is. It is a very good thing. And what fair trade is doing is setting a price. Doesn't necessarily mean, however, that price per metric ton for beans or for is actually still creating a living wage for the farmers who are doing that. And same sort of thing. It's like, as a chocolatier, I want to be able to deliver a really delicious, beautiful product to my clients and feel good about the price point so that it's not that at the super high end that says this is a luxury product. I mean, it is in many senses, but I also want people to be able to pick it up and go home and enjoy it and feel like they have a treat for themselves. So we all look at the price of every single ingredient that goes in, goes into what we're doing, whether it's cream, whether it's, you know, the you know, it's cream, it's butter, it's the chocolate itself. And over time, as I've learned and evolved and start thinking more about, you know, what the implications are of my own purchasing processes, I have really started winnowing that down. Hoping and getting really good feedback from consumers, you know, from my clients who are saying they like knowing the ethics behind what we're doing. Mm-hmm.
They're willing to pay a premium for that.
They are, and I still try to moderate what that means.
The challenge, right.
And that's really where the world of craft chocolate comes in. Whether it's, you know, our craft chocolate makers here in Utah or elsewhere in the country, that they're really, you know, they know their farmers. You know, it's not buying from just this big bin of beans. And they know their farmers. They're paying, you know, beyond just a fair trade wage. They're paying living things that create living wages for the farmers, partly to continue to grow excellent cocoa. That the fields aren't then turned into something else and growing yet more pineapples and bananas, which we've seen happen as well.
Well, just to loop back to that, what's going on in West Africa, based on the article in the Washington Post, it says that most of the boys are as young as 10, 11, 12 years old. And they say they come from Burkina Faso or nearby countries to the Ivory Coast. They're getting paid roughly $9 a week, of which the boys themselves only get four, half that.
Right, their supervisor is getting paid $9.
Their grand patron, as they're called, is getting half of their wages, which is on average maybe $9 or $10 a week. So you would think that, boy, if we could maybe give them $12 or $15 a week, would that really impact the cost of that Twix bar or that Mars? No. And that's the thing. Not to say that West African chocolate is bad. West African chocolate
delicious.
Is good.
Yeah.
That's where the cheapest chocolate is.
Yeah.
The cheapest cocoa.
Right.
Is.
And what we also see is from an industrial chocolate perspective, big cocoa as you refer to it, that there's a difference between companies that are family owned, that aren't beholden, they aren't traded on pick your stock exchange, whether it's here in the United States or it's in Europe, that they also aren't beholden to stockholders or other investors to also hit those profits that need to be distributed and to create, you know, to hit price points that make for a reasonable price bonbon. The investment is huge. The investment in equipment, whether even for, you know, myself, I mean, I was shocked. I mean, my one fancy piece of equipment I bought used from another chocolatier in Las Vegas and used, it was still $12,000. So when you're looking at, you know, doing millions and millions and millions of tons of chocolate, I mean, the infrastructure investments are huge also.
And having visited your place, in addition to the equipment, there's a lot of chemistry that's involved in this, a lot of thermodynamics, a lot of labor that goes into producing a piece of chocolate.
And that labor starts in the field. As you and I were talking yesterday, that the cocoa pods from the trees are hand harvested.
Why can't they be mechanically harvested?
And they can't be because if you nick the tree or you nick another blossom, you've damaged you know, the future growing opportunities for that tree. And so it's all hand done. It's, you know, a long stick with a metal blade on the end that I think took me about 20 minutes to get one.
One pod.
One pod.
So you visited this site where you're getting some of your cocoa.
Yeah, I've had the good fortune to travel both in Ecuador and in Costa Rica to see firsthand both the growing and really to understand. And now to get back to your point, that's exactly kind of think what was transformational for me is you intellectually understand it. And then when you're out there and you're in the fields and you're trying to do it yourself and like, my gosh, you know, you should be paid $1 billion for the precision, not only of cutting down the pod, but particularly in Central America and, you know, in South America, we had dealt with a fungus several years ago called Monilla. And the folks who are, you know, on the field and they're harvesting, I would look at a cocoa pod and be like, yeah, there's some black dots. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're good black dots. Maybe they're bad black dots. I have no idea. And these guys, you know, generally male, would look and they'd be like, no, Monia. And they would click, cut it open and you would see it. And then they would bury it in the under the duff underneath. So, I mean, it's the talent and the care and part of sort of their own culture and their own ethics about the quality of what they're doing in the fields. It really starts there from being, it's manual labor, and it has to be.
We're speaking with Phyllis Robinson. She's the owner and proprietor, founder of Tandem Chocolates right here in Park City. We're talking about, among other things, where she sources her chocolate, her cocoa, like you say, Ecuador and such.
So I was going to ask, you know, how did you get from the point of, you know, buying, a crate of a cocoa to being on the farm, you know, attempting to cut the cocoa on your own? You know, like, how did that process take place? How did you slowly get all the way there?
So I was fortunate that the program I went through, L'École Chocolat, one of the things they offered was a number of training programs.
Part of a certification?
Yes.
Licensing?
Yeah, so not a licensing, but just a sort of continuing ed program. And they had a program in Costa Rica, which let me go. And it was really about cacao cultivation and propagation. And my husband's a landscape architect as well, an arborist. And I thought, well, this is kind of a cool thing that we could both do together.
Yeah.
And I think in some respects he got into it even more than I did because of the propagation. We were at this Center for Agricultural Studies for Cacao. And all the science behind as they're trying to strengthen the tree's resistance against various fungus and things like that. Mm-hmm. You know, so it was really interesting to have that opportunity to be there. And it got me thinking even more. I mean, I've never used bad, crap chocolate. I've always, but it really got me delving even more into kind of the intricacies of what I'm doing. And I just have to give a huge shout out to our Bean to Bar makers, like Ritual Chocolate and Art Pollard and, folks who are buying these beans and making these amazing bars because talk about science and chemistry and love and commitment to your craft and ethics and, They're just awesome.
Artists as well as craftspeople.
Absolutely. And they come from a place of starting with the ethics of not just what they're producing, but talk about folks who literally know their farmers and travel to the places and select their beans and
shake the hand.
Yeah, exactly. So go buy craft chocolate.
These are small family run operations, small plots, small productions.
Right. For the most part. Yeah.
As consumers, what are the questions that we should be asking of, chocolate makers, or even if we want to buy a bar of chocolate in the grocery store, what are the certifications that we can trust?
Mm. It's never bad to look for things that say that things are fair trade. It's a starting point. It is. And actually, there was a piece that came out today that the Fairtrade USA and others are supporting a 20% increase in cocoa prices in West Africa as a direct result of this, without going into then cooperative funds for the villages to use. So it's not just, you'll get another dollar.
Right.
But putting it into it, and it's a lot of what the Fairtrade, USA and Fairtrade and other sorts of those programs go into. Looking into putting that money back into the communities and letting the communities decide, is it a school, is it drinking water, where does that money need to be spent? And that's why I love, places that I'm getting my chocolate from in Ecuador is, I know the woman who is actually making my chocolate.
Wow.
And the farmers who are growing the chocolate and which province that they're from and being able to really source it. And they all have different, different flavors and different profiles and they're roasted differently. It's like wine or coffee.
Mm-hmm.
But it means so much more that it's not just about having this amazing bonbon that you're eating, but understanding, thinking back with whether it's chocolate or it's anything, the entire supply chain that got that to your table. And that there are real people with real lives and families who do the same things that we do or want the same things that we want in terms of a better future for their children and, whether it's a place to worship or, a place to grow, and that it all started with that little bean, which then got me thinking about my packaging and that plastic lid on that box is going. We're phasing out.
You are.
We're phasing out all plastic and
okay,
because again, it's the what are the impacts we have on our environment? And
right,
some things are going to be inevitable, like I need to use, you know, gloves on things, but mm-hmm, TerraCycle will take my used gloves, for example.
Okay.
So I just think it's...
So you've been able to integrate some of these practices into your own business here in town, yeah, your own operation.
Yeah. And in little baby steps.
Yeah.
And,
right.
But I think it's that you take one step, you take another step. And, mm-hmm, you know, it's exciting and it's, you know, it's hard to rip the Band-Aid all at once.
Sure.
So
yep.
In a warming world,
uh-huh,
is there any plantations or farms here in the U.S.?
Good question. So cacao grows at about 20 degrees north and south of the equator.
Okay.
And what's been really interesting is we're seeing more growth. There's a fledgling industry in Hawaii.
Yeah.
It kind of ebbs and flows, but if you're in the islands, go visit, and you can even go make a little bit of your own chocolate and have some fun with it. There's a little upstart in Miami trying to grow some cacao trees there. Not saying that the climate change is a good thing, but it's interesting seeing a little
it's
bit
part
of that
of change.
Happening.
Changing.
It's changing.
Yeah. We always talk about that. It's part of change.
But we're also seeing, like Haiti has some really nice chocolate.
I bet.
We were talking yesterday about Vietnam.
Vietnam.
Yeah. And
okay,
you know, some other, you know, Southeast Asian countries.
How long does a typical cocoa tree lasts?
About 30 years.
And then it just exhausts itself and
yeah,
needs
kinda
to
like
be
the
replaced.
Rest of us. And, yeah, and so that becomes a challenge when a plantation starts to play itself out. What happens to that? And if the more the cacao can become a thriving industry, the less likely it is to become that banana plantation or pineapple plantation or whatever. I mean, I love both of those things, but I love chocolate more.
And you mentioned fungus as mm-hmm, a real concern. Are there any other pests that visit or any other life? What about any other biodiversity that uses these plantations?
So the upper stories of the trees.
Yeah.
You'll see monkeys. I was showing you photos of sloths,
wow,
which
right,
were pretty cool.
Sloths.
And monkeys, you know, kind of like the civic cat of the coffee industry. Mm-hmm. You know, the monkeys help to plant more cacao trees.
Okay.
The spread,
yeah.
Okay. But no other pests that they spray for or control?
You know, it really does depend on the plantation, and that's not really my area of expertise, but I know the fungus has been something that's been, you know, of significant concern of keeping that in check.
And it's interesting, like you say, how they control that. They see a pod that has fungus on it. Instead of just like taking it and driving it, you know, 60 miles away,
right,
they just bury it.
It's
in the
buried
ground.
In underneath all the duff.
It
can just decay because it's airborne on the shell. It's, you know, it's airborne, and they just want to make sure it's not going. And, you know, and it could be one pod on one tree. It's not necessarily that it's all, you know, all the pods on all the trees. It's like getting a cold. You may get one and you don't.
Right.
Okay. We're speaking with Phyllis Robinson, founder and proprietor of Tandem Chocolates. We're talking about where she sources her chocolate and some of the environmentally conscious activities she tries to affix herself to. Last couple questions. It was interesting that how you receive your chocolate. It's in a nondescript box.
Yeah,
delivered
I didn't know what
by
it is. This is a
FedEx.
Crate, a bag.
Yeah, exactly. It's not the classic burlap bag or something. Yeah. Like. No, it's just a box with plastic bag and is little discs.
Right.
Of chocolate.
Yeah.
That's how they're delivered, in like little communion wafers.
I know we were talking about we go to church much more often if I was getting this
Jersey
little
boy,
you know, chocolate host there.
Yeah.
The church should think about that.
Yes, something to consider.
Yeah. But that's how it's delivered in its raw form, and then that's what you manufacture your pieces from.
Yes. Yeah. And that little flat shape, that communion wafer shape, is good for melting. It helps me to evenly melt chocolate out. There's some places I get it, and that's partly the woman, Jenny San Diego and Conexión Chocolate. That's partly what they're doing. They're making chocolate specifically for my industry as a chocolatier. There are other places I get it, which is literally just in this huge block. And it's, you know, less expensive for everybody to produce. But for me, I have to then take kind of a nice pick kind of thing and break it all up into little pieces and stuff. So I am more than happy to pay someone else to make that for me.
Deliver it in that form. How do people get in touch? Do you take walk-ins at your place?
You know, this time of the year, we're not there a lot. We're doing a lot of product development during the summer.
Oh, really?
And, you know, new recipes and trying things out. And as you've noticed yesterday, it gets really warm in there during the day. So it's usually I'm there later, you know, early evening.
Yeah, that stuff will melt on its own.
Or it means I have to push my air conditioning, and I try not to push it down too low. And I'm just thoroughly, thoroughly thrilled that Jan Wilking was able to find me a place several years ago that had both running water and air conditioning. So second floor. But folks can give me a buzz. We're doing lots of weddings and events and special event kinds of things during the summer.
And website?
It's easier on Facebook for me, which is just Tandem Chocolates.
Okay. And again, as you were talking, I wrote down the word privilege, because in some ways, really, really good chocolate, like you say, there's a lot of time and effort and cost and blood, sweat, and tears that goes into a really, really good piece of chocolate. It's almost like a privilege to have a really good piece of chocolate.
That's a beautiful way of thinking about it. There's a lot of work that went into even to getting the pieces that we need to make that piece of chocolate.
Yeah, and there's a premium.
And
there's a price that comes with that. And we need to be comfortable with that.
Yep.
If we want to enjoy it. Well, Phyllis Robinson, thank you so much for joining us sharing with us your thoughts on this issue in West Africa and what's going to be done. And fair trade, that was interesting. Fair trade, look for fair trade and other labels and certifications.
Direct trade. If things are coming directly from a specific country, sometimes a little easier to trace. And then don't be afraid to go to websites and check out people.
If you're lucky to have, local chocolate makers like we are here in Park City, you can probably walk in the door and ask at the counter about these things.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Chocolatier Phyllis Robinson, thank you so much
Thanks.
For joining us. All right.